This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. I'm Samantha Donovan. This Wednesday, as Iran makes arrests in response to the downing of a Ukrainian passenger plane, questions are being asked about why its airspace was open when tensions were high with the US. And we hear from Sydneysiders celebrating the lifting of the city's lockout laws, but not everyone is welcoming the decision. First today, as the bushfire smoke haze continues to worry people in towns and cities in the nation's south and east, the federal government is allocating $5 million for medical research into the risk the pall poses to human health. The minister, Greg Hunt, says the money will be used to look into the health effects of bushfires and smoke. His announcement comes as the Australian Open tennis organisers again delay the start of practice and qualifying matches in Melbourne because of the poor air quality. Stephanie Boris has more.
The smell of smoke has become part of normal life for many residents. It's covered large parts of New South Wales, the ACT, South Australia and regional Victoria for weeks, and now it's hit Melbourne. Dr. Tony Bartone is the president of the Australian Medical Association.
This has been a very volatile season in terms of the number and the breadth and the depth of the fires and then the complicating smoke haze and air quality issues, and we need to be much better prepared.
He says doctors are seeing more patients than usual for this time of year.
Practices at the front line in the smoke-affected areas at the bushfire communities that have been devastated report regularly that the supplies of Ventolin, the supplies of asthma medications have dwindled to the very, very low levels.
The federal government has announced $5 million for bushfire-related medical research. Some of the cash will be used to study the mental health impacts of those in bushfire-affected communities. The rest will be used for research looking into the effects of prolonged bushfire smoke exposure. Dr. Tony Bartone is welcoming the announcement.
This will hopefully see a significant amount of both collection of information and then analysis and further research to guide us into the future, both advice and preparedness in dealing with the bushfire season.
Australia's top pollution experts are one step ahead of the government and are already putting together a team of researchers to investigate the medical fallout from the fires. Guy Marks is from the University of New South Wales.
Certainly in Australia, this is an unprecedented event. And so we don't really know what the effect is.
The immediate effects are being seen in medical practices and on the sporting field. In the ACT, the Brumbies and Canberra Raiders have moved their training camps interstate, while rowers in Sydney have flown to Tasmania in search of cleaner air. Melbourne is now facing similar issues. Tennis Australia has delayed today's qualifying matches due to poor air quality. Play is expected to begin this afternoon if conditions improve. Outside Melbourne Park, locals questioned whether it was safe for matches to go ahead.
I think it's pretty silly that they made players play yesterday, or if they're considering playing, making players play today.
I wouldn't want to be sort of pushing my body to the limits that they are.
Victoria's Chief Health Officer Dr. Brett Sutton says this isn't a one-off issue and is urging Tennis Australia to devise a long-term strategy.
They do have a heat policy. I think they need to plan out an air quality policy in the same way. We're going to have to do it with schools. We're working with the Department of Education to try and have similar kind of guidance for return to school for kids.
Racing Victoria has cancelled today's meetings at Caulfield and Yarra Valley due to smoke haze and poor air quality. Conditions in Melbourne are expected to improve this afternoon, but winds are expected to bring smoke back to the city over the weekend. The bushfire season is far from over, and some communities are unlikely to breathe clean air for several more weeks.
Stephanie Boris reporting. The federal science minister has rebuked her coalition colleagues for wasting time talking about whether climate change is real or not. Karen Andrews has made the remarks as she prepares to host a roundtable meeting of scientists today to look at how Australia should prepare for future bushfire seasons. For more, I'm joined by our political reporter, Alexandra Beach. Alex, what's Karen Andrews actually said to her colleagues who still aren't convinced by the science around climate change?
Well, Sam, she's issued a rather blunt message to them this morning. Firstly, she was quoted in the Nine newspapers saying that any time spent discussing whether or not climate change is really happening is wasted time and should instead be spent on figuring out what to do about it. And this comes as we've seen a slight shift as well in messages from the Prime Minister on climate change over recent days. Of course, over the weekend, he spoke about the government's climate policies continuing to evolve. But climate and energy policy is an issue that's divided the coalition party room for a long time. And there are still a handful of climate change sceptics in the government ranks. So Sydney backbencher Craig Kelly recently went on UK television making his views known. And this message is obviously aimed at that group. And Karen Andrews then reiterated the point on RN Breakfast this morning.
Every second that we spend talking about whether or not the climate is changing is a second that we are not spending on looking at adaptation, mitigation strategies. It's actually a comment to all parties that have been involved in this debate. It really is time for everyone to move on and to look at what we're going to do. In this case, to look at mitigating dangers associated with bushfires.
That's the Science Minister, Karen Andrews. But the opposition leader, Anthony Albanese, says this statement from her is extraordinary. And the fact that this debate is still happening at all, he says, shows the coalition can't be trusted to take action on climate change.
Karen Andrews is also hosting this roundtable meeting of scientists today to discuss ideas for future bushfire responses. What are you expecting will come out of that?
Yeah, so she'll be meeting top scientists from a whole range of institutions like the CSIRO and the Bushfire Cooperative Research Centre. The aim there is to discuss practical measures that she wants to see for future bushfire seasons. But this is one of a series of government roundtable meetings this week. We've already had the small business one, health, disability, transport sectors, and the Environment Minister also has a meeting of her own with environmental groups today as well. We've got education, financial services and several others coming up. So the government has at the same time been issuing pretty much daily announcements, sort of a detail a day of how the money from its $2 billion bushfire recovery fund is being spent. This all makes it seem like there is a lot going on in Canberra with these meetings. But after so much criticism of the Prime Minister's initial response to the bushfires, a cynic might also say that this is an attempt by the government to regain control of that situation and show that it is taking these fires seriously.
Political reporter Alexandra Beach, thank you. They are the most powerful media dynasty in the world, and now a very public division is opening up in the Murdoch family over how their companies cover climate change. In Australia, News Corp has been criticised by some politicians, scientists and members of the public in recent years for airing the views of commentators who deny that humans are contributing to the warming of the planet. And this morning, Rupert Murdoch's son, James, has attacked the company's reporting of the issue in light of Australia's bushfire crisis. David Sparks has the story.
Australia's extraordinary bushfire season has made headlines around the world. New York Times journalist Jim Rutenberg says Americans have been captivated.
You're seeing a lot of that coverage here. Even while we are going through sort of some of the biggest stories of our lifetimes, only the third impeachment in American history, the tension and military action against Iran, even in that climate, the Australian fires are often front page news. We at the Times have done a story about Murdoch Media's approach to it in Australia. So, yeah, it's very, very front of mind, even in this heavy, heavy news environment.
Jim Rutenberg recently wrote a series for The New York Times about the empire and influence of Rupert Murdoch. In particular, he's interested in how Mr. Murdoch's company, News Corp, and the family's US television branch, Fox News, cover climate change. His interest has only grown this morning after a representative of Rupert's son, James, and his wife, Catherine, provided this statement to the news site The Daily Beast.
Catherine and James's views on climate are well established, and their frustration with some of the News Corp and Fox coverage of the topic is also well known. They are particularly disappointed with the ongoing denial among the news outlets in Australia, given obvious evidence to the contrary.
James Murdoch sits on the News Corp board, but he's no longer an executive with the company, focusing instead on his role with a separate investment company. His criticism has further fueled the debate over how News Corp covers climate change.
James has had issues with the company's coverage of climate for his entire life, really. And I'm less surprised that he did this now than that it took this long.
James Murdoch's older brother, Lachlan, appears to be in line to take over from Rupert Murdoch as head of News Corp when the famous patriarch eventually steps down. Despite their Australian roots, Jim Rutenberg says the Murdochs are the first family of media in the United States, wielding vast power.
They dominate the Republican side of the climate debate, and they are a force in denialism.
The ABC has contacted News Corp for a response to James Murdoch's criticism. The company says it has no comment, but referred to an editorial in the Australian newspaper 4 days ago, in which the newspaper defended its coverage of climate change and the bushfires. It rejects claims the organisation facilitates climate change denial.
Right now, social media is driving a campaign of outrage in which an alleged right-wing conspiracy of climate denialism is framed as the key obstacle on the path to a better future. For all the clicks, this represents few people and no constructive ideas.
Tony Kosh is a retired journalist who spent 3 decades working for News Corp. He won 5 Walkleys and News Corp's most prestigious honour, the Sir Keith Murdoch Award. He's deeply concerned about the company's coverage of climate change, and he's glad James Murdoch spoke out.
I think he's an honest and decent person, and you know, what he's saying is so obviously true that it's you know, it needed to be said. And I'm on record as saying that I think that the Australian News Limited effort in looking at climate change is absolutely pathetic, quite juvenile, actually. You know, their commentators, particularly the Australian newspaper, are just absolutely, you know, it's ludicrous the attitude they're taking to what's obvious around the place with climate change.
News Corp has pledged an initial donation of $5 million to the Australian Bushfire Relief Campaign.
David Sparks reporting. And staying with bushfire relief efforts, and charities are describing a $50 million funding boost to help affected communities as a welcome first step. The money can be used to buy essentials like food, clothes and petrol, and for financial counselling. It's part of the federal government's $2 billion bushfire recovery fund and will be available through organisations like the Salvation Army and St Vincent de Paul. Minga Bali has more.
After spending a few days on the New South Wales south coast, Jack de Groot says people in fire-affected communities just want a sense of normalcy. But the chief executive of St Vincent de Paul Society New South Wales says that will be hard to come by when holiday destinations usually buzzing with activities are suddenly ghost towns.
Well, I was in Ulla Dulla yesterday, picked up a cup of coffee early afternoon in cafes that are pretty much vacant. And in January, mid-January, they would usually be full to bursting with people. Been able to get a hotel room in Gerringong fairly easily the other night, just as a place to stay, and yet we're in the peak of summer.
Recovery operations are underway across bushfire-ravaged communities, and while survivors come to terms with the cost of rebuilding their homes, some are also grappling with how to pay for everyday essentials. Mr. de Groot says that's exactly what the federal government's $50 million injection will help with.
The ability to either give cash or cash equivalents to those affected by the bushfires who've lost either their housing, their jobs, their livelihoods, to help them get through this emergency phase, paying their bills, whether that's the rent, whether that's a medical expense that they have, food, clothing.
Anne Hamdorf, a resident from Eden on the far south coast, has welcomed the money. She's also from the Country Women's Association, which is assisting with bushfire relief. Her home was spared, but with fires still raging to her north and south, she understands the sense of relief it could bring to those impacted.
There'd be a lot of extra expense in preparing for the fire because we knew the fires were coming. So people were, you know, trying to get fuel for their gen sets. And when you've lost everything, where do you start? I mean, it'd be untold amounts of costs for these people. Any assistance they can get would be greatly appreciated.
The money will primarily be administered by the Salvation Army Property Trust and the St Vincent de Paul Society. The government says the charities will work with local organisations to ensure access. Mr de Groot says the payments are there to make life easier and hopes they will help people regain a sense of control after the losses.
People have extraordinary resilience, and with that resilience there's still experience of anxiety as to how do I cope and how do I put myself back together again and my family, how do I pay for the kids as they start planning to return to school. And so people want their own authority, power, decision-making re-established.
But he also acknowledges this is only a first step on the long road to recovery.
They'll need more accompaniment over months and months ahead. This is not something that just gets fixed.
The government has also announced $50 million for wildlife recovery and $100 million for fire-affected farmers and primary producers.
Meghna Bali reporting. This is The World Today, and overseas now, Iran says it's made several arrests in connection with its downing of a Ukrainian International Airlines flight last week. President Hassan Rouhani says the world will be watching the investigation and it'll be overseen by a special court. Aviation experts and global affairs analysts say last week's crash shows the lessons of the 2014 MH17 disaster haven't been learnt, and they're calling for countries to rethink the process for closing airspace over conflict zones. Global affairs analyst Michael Bosacu told me the death of the 176 passengers last week gave him a terrible sense of deja vu.
Here we go again, where there was an active conflict zone and civilian aircraft were allowed to either fly over or through that active conflict zone. The airspace should have been closed down entirely given the threat level, but it wasn't. So hence we've had another massive loss of life. I should also say that this was one of the main recommendations from the Dutch Safety Board after MH17 was that in these types of environments, if you will, in these types of theaters, that's what needs to happen, airspace closed down.
There seems to be a bit of debate about who's actually responsible for closing the airspace. Do you believe it's the responsibility in this situation of Iran, or is it this international organisation, the International Civil Aviation Organisation?
Well, ICAO can give recommendations that are followed by signatory states, but it is really at the end of the day up to the sovereign states where these conflicts are happening to shut down their airspace. But, you know, as the chair of the Canada's National Transportation Safety Board said the other day, is that for some reason, jurisdictions that have conflict are reluctant to close down airspace. So there needs to be, I think, an immediate reevaluation by the civil aviation community to agree on some sort of practices or standards. Airlines can stop flying themselves, but I think if there is more information sharing, more awareness, that sort of thing, then we could see progress in this area.
So how then would you like to see changes made to the way airspace is closed in these situations? Who needs to step in?
Well, I think this is really in the purview of the United Nations. ICAO, I must admit, with all due respect to them, having worked for the United Nations, they're not exactly a body that moves very quickly. But these types of agreements, international agreements, require a lot of consensus, a lot of negotiation. They require countries to actually sign on to them to be effective. So if you don't have that, it's very, very difficult for these agreements to have kind of a universal type of coverage.
Russia still denies any involvement in the downing of MH17. How do you see that comparing with the position the Iranians have taken?
I do think that the Iranian decision to concede that it was one of their missiles is only a first step. Whether they're going to continue to be contrite and continue to provide a transparent, thorough investigation remains to be seen.
Do you think Iran would have made the admission had there not been so much surveillance footage around, I understand, as well as civilian videos?
Oh, there's no question. I think at the end of the day, they felt very boxed in. There were a number of factors here, I think, that led them to take that very unusual decision for them. One is that Ukrainian investigators did get on the ground quite quickly, and they were able to upload a lot of photographs and other information that really indicted the Iranians, that really pointed to missile fire. And yeah, the other aspects was the citizen journalism that was going on. All those videos and images being uploaded, there was Western intelligence satellite data, there was civilian air traffic data. So this is a match that has set off a huge fire in Tehran in terms of street protests. I think there's a lot of disgust at how the regime tried to manipulate the facts in the first few days and then admitted to downing an airplane full of promise, full of young, talented Iranians that were going home to go back to their jobs or their families. So this, there's a bit of irony here in that an airplane, a Ukrainian airplane from a country which had its own kind of people power revolution, has crashed and has set off a chain of events where we could see prolonged and maybe even historic protests in Iran.
Global affairs analyst Michael Bosiquiu. And the prospect of more protests in Iran comes as the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson calls for a new pact to replace the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, and as his government and those of France and Germany trigger a formal dispute under the deal over Iran's breaches of the pact. Well, on a lighter note now, parties are being held across Sydney this week to celebrate the lifting of the city's unpopular lockout laws. Critics have blamed them for decimating the city's nighttime economy. The laws do remain in place, though, in the popular King's Cross precinct. Our reporter Alex Tai ventured out after dark to gauge how the changes are being received.
I arrived at the Stonewall Hotel just after midnight and was straight away introduced to a drag queen.
Coco Jumbo.
Hi, wonderful.
Coco's hosting the lockout lifted party upstairs.
Nice to meet you. You look amazing.
Thank you.
Tell me what you're wearing.
I'm just wearing a little bit of black sequin and a little bit of afro just to bring back the disco era that's about to hit Oxford Street.
All right, with the lifting of the lockout laws?
Amen, yes, of course.
How are you going to celebrate?
I'm going to celebrate by having a shot after midnight. It's so naughty, but it's been a few years, so I'm looking forward to it.
As Coco was telling me about her plans now the lockout laws are lifted, we were interrupted.
Girly time.
And hey, that's all right. You can jump in if you want. ABC.
Okay. You have a lighter for me?
What? Yes, I do.
Yeah, perfect. I love your dress.
Thank you. Do you want to have a shot after midnight?
Thank you. What's the entry for this bar?
No entry.
No entry?
It's free for everybody.
Okay, I think I will join it.
Yeah, baby, come on in.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, are you not from Sydney?
No, from Germany.
Right. Do you know this is a special night? They're lifting the lockout laws in Sydney.
Oh, yeah, I heard before.
Yeah.
What's the meaning? What's lockout?
So, not too long ago, there was a time where after 1 o'clock, you couldn't go into any of these beautiful venues on Oxford Street, and you'd be locked out. And like,
you can't go in.
You can't go inside after 1 o'clock. And now you can come in whenever you like and
whatever
have
you
some
like
fun and enjoy yourself.
5 a.m. or...
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, that's good.
I'm on the floor.
Oxford Street is a short walk from St Vincent's Hospital. So I'm outside St Vincent's Hospital now, and St Vincent's has been strongly in favour of the lockout laws. They're the hospital that is closest to King's Cross, and it's often the place where people are brought when they've been injured by alcohol-fuelled violence.
Well, it was like turning off a tap for us.
Paul Price is the medical director of the emergency department at St Vincent's. He says that when the lockout laws were introduced, the hospital saw an immediate change.
It was incredibly dramatic, and obviously we're a trauma centre, so we were getting a lot of cases from many areas, but particularly King's Cross, which was a very crowded, sort of densely packed space that had a lot of venues that sold a lot of alcohol.
All right, let's keep going to King's Cross.
It's around 2:30 a.m. here on Darlinghurst Road. There are a lot of seagulls on the street. I can't see a lot of people. It's a very different scene from Oxford Street, where I've just come from. King's Cross was the place where two young men were killed by alcohol-fueled violence, 2012 and 2014. And it was those deaths that led to the introduction of the lockout laws. Now, those laws are going to remain in place here in King's Cross. And you can hear the difference. The whole street is still lit up, but there's no one really out on the streets. It's a very different scene. That's the street sweeper making its way up Darlinghurst Road. There's not much else going on.
That report from Alex Tye, and that's the world today for this Wednesday. I'm Samantha Donovan. Have a good afternoon.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.